This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. There is a great deal we still do not know about the bomb attacks in Riyadh, including the exact number of those killed and injured. But the outlines of this latest terrorist incident are beginning to emerge. Yesterday, at about 11:30 p.m. local time, gunmen shot their way through the security gates at three residential areas in the Saudi capital, drove inside, and detonated carloads of explosives. A fourth attack took place early today at the headquarters of the Saudi Maintenance Company, which is a Saudi-American venture. Saudi officials say they believe that the bodies of nine suicide bombers have been recovered from the wreckage, although other reports say that at least some of the attackers may have escaped. At least seven Americans are among the dead. Jordanians, Filipinos, and Saudi Arabians were also reported killed, along with at least one Lebanese and one Swiss. The Saudi Interior Minister, Prince Nayef, said that the blood of Saudis is mixed with the blood of Americans. The minister told a Saudi newspaper that the attacks were related to the discovery of a large weapons cache in Riyadh earlier this month, and suspicion fell immediately on Al-Qaeda. At one point, a State Department official put the total number of dead at 91, but later statements put the number closer to the Saudi estimate of 29. This afternoon, Vice President Dick Cheney used the number 91 again. It's not clear whether that represents an upward revision or just a repetition of that earlier number. The bombs detonated as Secretary of State Colin Powell was en route to Riyadh. He continued with his scheduled visit, met with Saudi officials, and visited one of the bomb sites before flying on to Moscow. NPR's Michelle Kellerman accompanied Secretary Powell, but she stayed behind in Saudi Arabia. She joins us now from Riyadh. Michelle, good of you to speak with us tonight.
Sure.
What's the latest news on the number of casualties? Is it still as confused as it was a few moments ago?
It is still as confused. I've been talking to U.S. officials here who say the 91 figure may be possible, but it's still way too early to tell because of the devastation at all of these sites. There are many people that are not accounted for. They expect to hear some more solid figures from the Saudi government tomorrow, but so far they're not ready to confirm that 91 figure. Secretary Powell, before he left, talked about 10 Americans, maybe less, and I talked to some people who were in another compound who know for sure of 10 others, so we know we're in the 20s, but I'm not sure how high we're going to go.
Is there any more information on what happened?
Well, I mean, Powell went to one of the sites, and we talked to an Army officer there who described how the attack happened. I also talked to some people who witnessed the similar attacks in the other places, and they really did follow this pattern. Basically, the one that we went to, which was the Vinnell Corporation headquarters, I can talk about that a bit later, but what happened is two drivers came up, two cars, two vehicles, gunshots were heard, the gunmen got past the security guards or killed the security guards, we're not really sure in all of the details, managed to open up these metal gates. I mean, all of these compounds, the security is incredible. They managed to open up these gates, they drove in, and they drove right up in front of this one big apartment block, the one that most people are living in, and that was a similar situation in another one where they drove to the most densely populated area of the compound and detonated the bomb. This Army officer said, as for there was a car still outside of the compound, and what happened to the guy who drove that car is still unclear, whether he got away, whether the Saudis have captured him, it's still very unclear.
Now, these compounds, these residential compounds, are walled not just for security purposes, but also because they house mostly Westerners who, if they can, prefer not to go in accord with a lot of the restrictions of Saudi rules that put on women, for example.
That's right. But actually, you know, some of these compounds, there are a lot of Saudis living there, too, so it is quite mixed. The one that I talked to some people that lived in one called the Alhambra, and they said there are many Muslims, not only Saudis, but Jordanians, Palestinians. These people happen to be from Turkey. There is a British school nearby, so there were some British teachers who had been living in the compound off and on. And, you know, also these compounds are for, they cater sort of to the corporate executives. There's a very large expat community here in Riyadh. I've seen numbers up to 35,000 Americans, oil executives, a lot of military contractors in addition to that. So there's a big expat community, and this is the way most of them live, in these big compounds and guarded compounds.
Now, you mentioned you were at the site of the Vinel Corporation. That's a company that's, I guess, based in Virginia is what I've read, and it has a contract to train Saudi National Guardsmen.
That's right, and they've been here for many years. Apparently there are about 500 people that work and live in this compound. They actually that work out there, and it's pretty far out of the city. This is a sprawling city, so it was about 30-40 minutes from the center of town. And what we were told was that there are about 70. They also, in these compounds, they have the bachelor apartments, so the single men or the men that don't come with their families, their wives. So this was the bachelor apartment that was really mostly devastated in this bombing, that 70 men live in that particular building. This Army official that we talked to said the only good news of the day was that 50 of them happened to be on this training mission in the desert last night at around 11:30 when all of these attacks happened.
What did it look like after the bombing?
The whole facade of this building was just ripped off. You could see, you know, the remnants in these apartments, some of the, not clothes, but I saw, you know, linens and towels hanging off the rubble. You can see some bookshelves. I mean, the apartments themselves look pretty barren. They don't look very well lived in, very nice. But it was just a mess. There was metal twisted all over the place, glass. Nearby, you could see what they thought was a pickup truck that was carrying the explosives, and it was flipped over and just charred. And then next to it, you had this series, this row of three sort of barrack-like buildings. The roofs were completely torn off. The windows were all blown apart. It was just an incredible mess. When we happened to be there with the secretary, in addition to this mess, a huge sandstorm came in. So everybody quickly got in their cars and left. It was a fairly brief visit there.
I understand you did get the chance, though, to talk to at least one survivor from a bombing today?
Yes, it was a couple. They're from Turkey. They lived in the Alhambra compound, and they also went back and took video that they showed me of their compound, which was completely devastated. Again, in that case, the truck bomb or car bomb went right into the center near the more luxury villas. They happened to be in an apartment building, which was set back a little bit, so they weren't the people in their building weren't killed. But in the villas, this woman knows of about 10 people who were killed there, including two young girls, she said. Hmm. And the scene there also was just devastating. She said there was a huge pit of 25 feet deep in the middle of this. She saw that what they heard, it sounded like they said firecrackers, fireworks. They didn't really know what was going on, so they went out to look and then saw this huge orange explosion, and they were blown back to the other end of their living room. The window frames, the huge, you know, sliding door windows all came crashing in, and they said a lot of the people in their building were sleeping at the time, and these windows came crashing on their beds, and that's how they were injured. This couple happened to be awake, so they were lucky not to have been hit by that, and they have a 3.5-year-old child who she said was sleeping on the edge of his bed, so he also luckily escaped serious injury.
Michelle Kellerman, thanks very much. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
NPR's Michelle Kellerman speaking with us from Riyadh in Saudi Arabia. Joining us now for some more background in the story is Paul Wilkinson, chairman of the Center for the Study of Terrorism and Political Violence at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland. And, Professor, welcome back to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you. First of all, may I express heartfelt sympathy for the relatives of those who died and for those injured in these outrages in Riyadh.
Thank you very much, Professor. Secretary Powell said, and I think it was foremost on everybody's mind, that this had all of the fingerprints of Al-Qaeda.
I think that's absolutely right. We know there has been a claim from Al-Qaeda. And even before that, it was clear that this was the work of a ruthless terrorist network, which has already shown its total disregard for any humanitarian concern in the violence that it's committed in America and elsewhere.
You said there had been a claim of responsibility. Where was that?
I understand in Saudi Arabia itself. It's being reported in the agencies over here in Europe.
Ah, we had not seen it yet, so perhaps we're just lagging a little bit behind on that. You know, we had thought, obviously, that Al-Qaeda had been significantly weakened after the disruption of its terrorist camps that it used for training facilities in Afghanistan and the arrest of considerable numbers of its top leadership, though obviously not the top two members of its leadership, Osama bin Laden and Zayman al-Zawahiri. But clearly it has latent capabilities if this is indeed their work.
I think that's right. I think that Al-Qaeda was badly damaged by the overthrow of the Taliban regime, which had given it shelter and a useful base from which to operate. And it certainly has suffered the loss of some of its most effective terrorist organizers. But, of course, that doesn't mean that it has been put out of business. And we have known for some time that they have been adapting to their new circumstances, moving resources around to avoid the block on funding from the Western banking system, using different methods to move their funds around. We know that they have been finding other means of training people now that they can't use the training camps in Afghanistan. And they have replaced the people who've been captured or killed in the recent months. So they are still very much a threat. And I think the U.S. government and the government of the United Kingdom are well aware of the great deal of work that has to be done before we can say that we've unraveled this very dangerous network.
You say new kinds of training facilities. Where? Run how?
Well, it means that they are sending people further afield, for example, to their affiliated groups in Southeast Asia, in places like Indonesia, the Philippines, the Caucasus, people working with the Chechen fighters, getting training in the various struggles that are taking place, for example, in Kashmir, and using the training facilities that are provided for the groups that are active in those areas. And we have to remember that some of those groups are affiliated with or closely linked to Al-Qaeda.
Now, there was a cache. We're going to have to hold on this question because we're running up against a break, Professor Wilkinson. I hope you can stay with us for a couple of minutes.
Yes, of course.
And obviously, if you out there have questions about a reformed and adapted Al-Qaeda, about its structure, about its capabilities, give us a phone call. Our number is 989-8255, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Also, a little bit later in the program, we'll be joined by former Ambassador Richard Murphy to talk about the aspects of this attack that were directed against the Saudi royal family and about the Saudi royal family and the Saudi government's engagement with and against terrorism over the years. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about the bombings that took place yesterday and early this morning in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. Again, it looks as if three residential compounds occupied mostly by foreign nationals were the targets of car bombings. There was also one explosion at a joint Saudi-American company, all in Riyadh. So far, the numbers of those killed and injured are up in the air, as Saudi estimate at least 29 people dead, perhaps 190 injured. The State Department at one point used a figure of 91 dead. So did Vice President Cheney. Firm number has yet to arrive. If you'd like to join the discussion, give us your questions about the bombings. Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address again, totn@npr.org. And with us on the line is Paul Wilkinson, chairman of the Center for the Study of Terrorism and Political Violence at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland. And Professor Wilkinson, it seems sometimes unlikely for those of us in the news business to remember, particularly after the events of 9/11, but just give us a capsule summary of the history of al-Qaeda and its founder, Osama bin Laden.
Well, the al-Qaeda movement emerged in the 1980s after the defeat of the Soviet occupation in Afghanistan. Osama and his colleagues had cut their teeth, so to speak, in what was essentially a rural guerrilla war against the Soviet invaders. And they had enormous help from the United States, and they were able to show that by hypermobile guerrilla activity, they could make the life of the Soviet forces in Afghanistan unbearable, and that forced a withdrawal. And they believed that they could now turn their attentions to the United States because they deeply resented the American presence in Saudi Arabia close to the holy places. And they decided that if they could make violence work against one superpower, they could make it work in making the Americans withdraw from the Middle East and reverse their policies on Israel and on many other things. And ultimately, they hoped to set up a pan-Islamist state. And that movement grew during the 1990s, and undoubtedly not only the American intelligence community, but the European intelligence services and governments underestimated the extent to which al-Qaeda had embedded people in a number of countries ready to commit major terrorist acts. And we began to see some of these acts in the 1990s. There was the Khobar Towers bombing, which killed 19 American servicemen in 1996 in Saudi Arabia. There was the terrible attack on the U.S. Embassy in Nairobi, a simultaneous attack on the U.S. Embassy in Dar es Salaam in 1998. And then we had the tragic events of 9/11 bringing home to us the lethality of this organization, which is the most destructive and deadly terrorist organization we've ever seen in the history of terrorism.
Let's go to questions from callers. Carl joins us on the line from Portland, Oregon.
Yes, good afternoon or good morning here. I was wondering whether the war in Iraq has aided or inhibited al-Qaeda. I've heard speculation in both directions. In particular, on the aided side, that because we have angered the Arab street, that al-Qaeda will get more recruits and more funding.
Professor Wilkinson?
I think it has been of help to the al-Qaeda because bin Laden sees it as a great propaganda opportunity. He can say that this is a case of the United States and Britain invading a Muslim country. And that is indeed the message that he sent out in a recent audio tape to try and mobilize his followers into carrying out further attacks. And I think it's also very likely that more funds have come into the organization as a result of the deep feelings in the Muslim world about the war in Iraq. So I think on balance that was really a setback as far as the war on al-Qaeda is concerned.
Okay, Carl, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Let's go to Karen, and Karen's with us from Columbia, South Carolina.
Hi.
Hi.
Yes. I'm really struck by the element that seems to be missing from current news reports and analysis. We're speaking of this as though al-Qaeda is somehow separate from the Saudi government and religious theocracy. I wonder if your guest could comment about the fact that, in fact, Saudi Arabia originated, funded, and supported the most violent internal Islamic extremism, first directed against other Muslims, primarily Shia and Sufi. Of course, I'm speaking of Wahhabi Islamic extremism. And it seems as though we don't notice it until it appears in the West. In addition, I wonder if you could comment about the fact that Al-Qaeda is as though it were the stepson of Saudi extremism that has escaped control and is now returning to attack what it sees as a corrupt and irreligious alliance between the Wahhabi and the government of Al-Saud in the country. So I'll wait for the comment and appreciate your guest.
Okay, thank you, Karen. Professor Wilkinson, any comment there?
Well, that's a very interesting and complex question. I think that Wahhabi Islam certainly has a reputation for being very aggressive in its attitude towards other varieties of Islam practice. Certainly in the early history of the Arabian Peninsula, there were many different conflicts between these strands of Islam, which were very violent. And some of those carried on right up until quite recent historical times. But we don't have a precedent for Al-Qaeda with its transnational terrorist agenda. I think it would be unfair to label Al-Qaeda as the stepson of Saudi Arabia. It is truly a multinational mix of people. It is true that 15 of the suicide hijackers on the 9/11 attacks were from Saudi. But, of course, they have Algerian, Egyptian, Yemeni, Pakistani, Indonesian, and other members from a whole variety of countries, and, of course, some of them recruited in the Muslim diasporas in the Western world. And we have to remember that the agenda of the Al-Qaeda organization is very ambitious and universalistic. It doesn't simply apply to the politics of Saudi Arabia. They would like to remove the government, the rulers in Saudi Arabia, and the Saudi Arabian government knows that Al-Qaeda is a major threat to its own survival. And I think it would be dangerous, too, to assume that the majority of Saudi citizens are in favor of the terrorist campaign of Al-Qaeda. It doesn't take large numbers of people, unfortunately, to organize terrorist attacks. After all, it was only 19 suicide hijackers who committed such terrible outrages and such massive lethality on 9/11. And therefore, we shouldn't try, I think, to characterize the whole of the Saudi Arabian people as somehow guilty of the terrorism that Osama bin Laden and his followers have developed. They are a minority movement in the Muslim world, but they're very fanatical, they're very dangerous, and the big job we have is really to get international cooperation, including the cooperation of the Saudi authorities, to track down these cells and to bring them to justice so that they cannot carry out any more of these terrible outrages.
Well, joining us now is someone who may have help us on this exact point, Ambassador Richard Murphy, a former ambassador to Saudi Arabia, who also served as Assistant Secretary of State for the Near East under President Reagan. And Ambassador Murphy, good to have you back on the program.
Thank you so much.
And precisely on that point, if Al-Qaeda is not a creature of the Saudi government, certainly there are elements within the Saudi royal family and indeed in other royal families in the Gulf region that have been helpful to Al-Qaeda, have they not?
No question that money has flowed to Al-Qaeda, some deliberately, certainly, and some unknowingly through being diverted by passing through some of the Saudi charitable foundations.
And given what we assume Al-Qaeda being behind today's attack, and again, we're not clear on that point as yet, but as everybody has said, including Secretary of State Powell, the fingerprints of Al-Qaeda are on this explosion. Earlier, we had Professor Wilkinson talking to us about the earlier explosion at Khobar Towers. The Saudis were very unhelpful in a joint U.S.-Saudi investigation of who was behind that. Do you think that they may have learned from that?
Well, I hope so, and I think that will be proved to be the case. The FBI descended on them en masse. I mean, at one point, 100-plus FBI agents in the kingdom trying to get cooperation, trying to get access to those whom the Saudis had arrested. They never did get direct access. But I think Khobar was 1996. Since then, there's been, of course, the World Trade Towers and the assistance that the Saudis have given us during the war against Iraq. And now they see this atrocity committed right in their own capital. I think that there will be better cooperation, and they're more used to us. They're more used to the FBI's way of operating, mm-hmm. in specific.
Let's get another caller. Dan joins us from Amherst, Massachusetts.
Hello.
Hi.
I just have a quick point to make, which I think the gentleman from England alluded to, which is that one of the principal objectives of al-Qaeda, as stated by bin Laden, was to get the U.S. out of Saudi Arabia. And in fact, he can now say he has succeeded because we are pulling out of Saudi Arabia. We're moving bases to Qatar and to Iraq. And in the same way that suicide bombing drove the Israelis out of Lebanon, and this was seen as an important victory and a major model, this is reinforcing terrorism as a tactic for these people. They can point to a major platform success for themselves.
Paul Wilkinson, obviously you're in Scotland, not England. We'll make that correction. That's quite all right.
Yeah, I apologize.
Obviously the announcement that the bulk of U.S. forces were to be withdrawn from Saudi Arabia came well in advance of this bombing in the last couple of days.
Yes, I think that the move made by the Defense Department was clearly made on defense grounds, really strategic grounds. It's certainly possible that that's been interpreted by supporters and sympathizers of al-Qaeda as a victory for them. But on the other hand, they still have been determined to carry out this massive attack, and I think that's because they want to eliminate the entire presence of Western countries, civilians, commercial companies, and so on, because they have, as President Bush has pointed out, a deep hatred which fuels their terrorist campaign. And I don't think that any political changes of the kind that we've been discussing will alter the potential of al-Qaeda for terrorism. I don't think there is a political or diplomatic pathway out of al-Qaeda terrorism. We have to face up to using the intelligence cooperation that we're building up with the Coalition on Terrorism. We have to use the criminal justice system, as we are doing in Europe and elsewhere, to bring these people to justice. It's a hard job. It requires great patience and determination. But recent arrests and trials, for example, that are now ongoing in Southeast Asia, show that we can make this cooperation work, and we can inflict great blows on the terrorist network, and I believe ultimately we will defeat them.
We're speaking with Professor Paul Wilkinson and Ambassador Richard Murphy about the bomb attacks in Riyadh overnight. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Ambassador Murphy, I wanted to bring you in on this last point. Even if the announcement of U.S. withdrawal of, again, most of its forces comes in advance, can't this be spun by al-Qaeda, supporters to say, well, they were fearing just such an attack as we were able to pull off?
Well, I'm sure they'll spin it, but I think we did the best possible in presenting the withdrawal for what it was. The mission was over. Operation Southern Watch in Iraq was finished. There was no need of the troops, and there was a very amicable meeting between Secretary Rumsfeld and Prince Sultan, the Minister of Defense, to say, this isn't abandoning Saudi Arabia. Thank you for the help, and if needed, we'll help again another time. So I think that was the best possible way to have presented it, but that doesn't prevent al-Qaeda from manipulating the facts.
Okay. Dan, thanks very much for the phone call. Let's go now to Amir, and Amir joins us from Ann Arbor in Michigan.
Hi, I have two questions. My first one is about the frequency of Al-Qaeda attacks before and after September 11th, and if the actions of the United States since, which have been just ridiculous amounts of things have happened, have they had any effect in the frequency and even scope? And also, the one guest said that it only was 19 hijackers, but there was certainly, you know, money and other sort of support staff, and I'm wondering if there's a separation in the Al-Qaeda organization between those who give the command to suicide, attack, or bomb, and those who actually do it. Is there a grunt level versus a general?
Professor Wilkinson, I think that's to you.
Well, I think the first part of the question is a very interesting one. I think you could say that the actions taken not just by the United States alone, but by the U.S.-led coalition against terrorism have made a serious impact on al-Qaeda. They have made it more difficult for al-Qaeda to operate in various countries and to successfully carry out attacks. And that's why we have knowledge now of a number of thwarted attacks intercepted through in good intelligence work, good police work, for example, in Singapore, in France, Germany, Italy, the United Kingdom. We know that these plots have been thwarted. That is an achievement. So there would have been more attacks if we hadn't been cooperating effectively. I think that that doesn't mean we can feel complacent and feel that, that we're doing everything that needs to be done. There is room for great improvement in our intelligence effort, particularly because gathering human intelligence on the intentions and plans of a secretive network like al-Qaeda is an extremely challenging task, and we still haven't yet got enough trained people with the language skills and all the necessary tradecraft to do that job effectively. And as long as that is the case, there is a dangerous intelligence deficit.
We're going to continue taking some questions about the incidents in Riyadh overnight and what they impend for the future of U.S.-Saudi relations and for the future of the war on terrorism. Our phone number again is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address, TOTN@NPR.org. When we come back from the break, we'll also be exploring the emergence of the new political and religious leadership in post-war Iraq. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about the bomb attacks that happened in Riyadh overnight. Three car bomb explosions, suicide car bombs apparently, at residential compounds in Riyadh, mostly occupied by foreign nationals. There are at least 29 dead, it's believed. We have heard figures of as many as 91, but at this point it's impossible to confirm. Apparently as many as 190 injured, though, again, reports from Saudi Arabia say many of them injured lightly. All of these numbers are going to continue to change and fluctuate as reports continue to come in and rubble is moved, and we'll bring you up to date on that all day long here on NPR News, and of course tune in to All Things Considered later for the latest on that. Our guests are Ambassador Richard Murphy, who's a senior fellow for the Middle East at the Council on Foreign Relations, and Professor Paul Wilkinson of St. Andrews, Scotland. And Ambassador Murphy, earlier we heard Secretary Powell say, and I'm quoting here, we should not try to cloak this terrorist activity, criminal activity, murderous activity in any trappings of political purpose. They are terrorists. And you can understand a government official saying that in the immediate aftermath of an atrocity. Nevertheless, there has to be political purpose behind this.
Well, I would say there definitely was a political purpose. It's get rid of the leadership of Saudi Arabia and unstated put supporters of al-Qaeda's way of thinking in charge. Then it will be a pious state, a good Muslim state, which it has been deplored by al-Qaeda and its predecessors ever since King Fahd invited the Americans and the international coalition into the kingdom back in 1990.
Obviously, the other political purpose we were talking about was attacks in general on the United States and its presence in the Kingdom of the Two Holy Places.
Yes, Well, that was specific on the part of Osama bin Laden himself in the last several years, that he wanted our troops out of the Holy Land, which really meant the whole Arabian Peninsula.
Let's get another caller. Jim joins us from Forest Ranch in California.
Neil, I've got two questions. The first one for Ambassador Murphy. Do you know what the nature of the training was that so many of the foreign nationals who escaped injury last night, apparently they were out in a training mission at 11 o'clock at night. Was this sort of some sort of counterinsurgency training that they were involved with?
I don't specifically know, but we've had a number of companies in the in Saudi Arabia over the years, past generation and more, on supporting training for the Army, the National Guard, the Air Force, the Navy, but specifically what they were training for at this point in time, I'm sorry, I don't know.
Okay, and the second question for Professor Wilkinson. When the United States was providing funding for training for arms and for logistics for the Mujahideen before they morphed into Al-Qaeda...
You're talking about in Afghanistan.
In Afghanistan. Were these people that the United States was supporting at that time, were those people terrorists? Or were they freedom fighters?
I believe that insofar as they were fighting a foreign occupier and they were attacking the military personnel of the Soviet Union at that time, they were engaged in a hypermobile guerrilla war. And it's interesting that when they decided they would go into urban terrorism, they had to learn the techniques of urban terrorism. They weren't used to that. They weren't expert in it. And they acquired their expertise not from Saudi Arabia, of course, but from Egypt. The manual that has been used as a training manual by so many al-Qaeda operatives is ultimately really an Egyptian-prepared document. Very knowledgeable, full of what is really very good advice for terrorists on how to remain covert, how to communicate secretly, how to use poisons and various terrorist tactics. And, you know, that's really the way in which they acquired their expertise, by tapping the experience of movements that had waged urban terrorism.
So your take on it is that the United States were not sponsoring terrorism at that point, and that they merely morphed into it under the influence of Middle East countries who are perhaps more barbaric than the United States.
Yeah, and particularly under the influence of Zawahiri, I think, who was determined that terror was the way forward, it would be the tactic that would work.
Okay, Jim, thanks very much.
Certainly, thank you.
And we're going to have to leave it there. Professor Wilkinson, we appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Paul Wilkinson is chairman of the Center for the Study of Terrorism and Political Violence at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland, and also Ambassador Richard Murphy. Always appreciate your taking the time to join us on the program. Richard Murphy is a senior fellow for Middle East at the Council on Foreign Relations and a former ambassador to Saudi Arabia.